A question about a consumer product that sitteth at the right hand of your faucet. From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Faced with holiday travel next to sneezing, snuffling human petri dishes, many like to arm themselves with antibacterial soap. Thing is, does the stuff actually work? There's news the Food and Drug Administration is asking makers of antibacterial soap to prove their product is more effective than plain old. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith joins us with the nitty-gritty. Hello, Stacey.
Hi, David.
So why is the FDA wringing its hands about antibacterial soap?
Well, it's very popular. It's a billion-dollar industry. Millions of Americans are using these products, and we're talking everything from body wash to toothpaste. There's a concern now that too much exposure to these products can cause some problems. For instance, antibiotic-resistant bacteria and even hormonal effects on people. Plus, the FDA says there's no evidence right now that these products are more effective than regular soap at preventing people from getting sick.
So should we also question using those hand sanitizers at the store and the airport?
Well, no. Most hand sanitizers are mostly alcohol, so they're not part of this rule. And also antibacterial products used in healthcare settings like hospitals wouldn't be affected. This is really focusing on consumer products like body washes and soaps. And there's a worry that people are just using these things all the time and that overexposure could start having effects.
What does this mean for all the companies that make these products?
Well, nothing's coming off the shelf right now, and the companies have a year to prove that antibacterial products are safe and that they're more effective than regular soap. If they can't, they'll have to change their formulas or relabel their products.
All right. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith, thank you very, very much. The Beatles have a new release out today. It's on iTunes, and it's new in the sense that they're recordings that have never been sold commercially. There are 59 songs in all, mostly from BBC performances, outtakes from studio sessions, and demos from 1963. While there may be demand from Beatles fans, the release also has a lot to do with copyright law. Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
Most casual Beatle fans probably aren't that interested in five new versions of A Taste of Honey. And most hardcore Beatles fans have already heard what's being released because there are thousands of bootleg copies available in what Beatles historian Bruce Spicer calls a gray market.
It's not a case where somebody's going to come and arrest you for owning a bootleg. However, if you're selling bootlegs, then that certainly would be in violation of the law.
But that European Union law recently changed. Under the old law, a copyright was good for 50 years from the date the recording was made. Under the new rules, copyright owners can get a 20-year extension if the original recording is released in the first 50 years. Kevin Parks is an intellectual property attorney.
And were it not for this recent European Union extension of copyright law pertaining to sound recordings, they would fall into the public domain.
That would mean bootleggers could legally sell their copies for a profit, a threat that put enough pressure on Apple Records to get them to open its vault to the public. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Marketplace is listener-supported. I know that just goes in one ear and out the other, but it means it is supported by listeners like you. So to keep our coverage compelling, up-to-date, up-to-the-minute, if you can, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift, in any amount, will support your daily dose of business insight from us. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. You can donate by going to marketplace.org by the end of the year, December 31st. Thanks. In today's tech world, alongside the tales of the newly minted young male billionaire entrepreneurs, another narrative is emerging: the comparative absence of women. Up to 90% of the engineering teams at startups are men. As Marketplace's Queen Akim reports, some women in the Silicon Valley are trying to engineer some change.
It's recruitment day at Hackbright Academy, a coding school for women. And 24-year-old G. Kang, who just finished up the Academy's 10-week crash course, is showing off the photo app she built to recruiter Paul Sri. He's with Chegg, an online textbook company. Kang explains that her app is modeled on Japanese photo booths.
So I was trying to go for that.
Have you seen Google Hangouts where you can try on a scuba mask and like a hat?
Well, that's actually my next thing.
Kang didn't study computer science in college. And a lot of the women you find at these academies, and they're sprouting up all over Silicon Valley, work in tech, but mostly as product managers, marketers, and researchers. Instead of playing what some of them describe as support roles, The women want to make stuff too. In the past, to do this, women felt they needed to take a more traditional route and get an engineering degree. So this sort of self-training is a new concept for women. But Paul Shree says men have been doing it this way since the beginning.
Most people who I know now who do programming did not study computer science and really no exposure to programming at all.
Silicon Valley is infamously male-dominated, but Sydney Padnis says that doesn't mean women have to behave like one to get ahead.
I really don't want to encourage women to go out there and be like men. I don't think that's a good answer either.
Padnis is the founder of Illuminate Ventures. She says women have a lot to offer when it comes to running a company. They're often more collaborative and generally more open to ideas.
When I see a pitch from a male entrepreneur, it's typically much more aggressive in terms of their revenue plan. So I'm busily discounting, well, they'll do half of that.
Whereas more often than not, Padnis says women are more realistic.
But I'm not sure every male investor recognizes that, because they're so used to seeing those overdone pitches.
Padnis says for now, that blind spot is turning into a competitive edge. 20% of the startups that Illuminate backs are founded by women. That's way higher than the industry average. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
And for those of you lamenting that the only thing Facebook is missing is video advertising that pops up in your face, a solution is at hand as the social media company tries to get a piece of the $66 billion TV-style ad market. Teasy little shorts or something that requires a full bowl of popcorn, we shall see when the Facebook ads start popping up later in the week. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.